Now, please have Psalm 93 open in front of you, which we read earlier. Now, I wonder, what did you think of our reading? What do you think of Psalm 93? When you look beyond the grandeur of the language in Psalm 93, did it yield much meaning? Look at the way it begins. The Lord reigns. He is robed in majesty. The Lord is robed. He has put on strength as his belt. Here's a description of God reigning as king. He's robed in majesty and power, and he reigns. But is it real? Where does God reign? How does God reign? And actually, does God really reign anyway? Now, Queen Elizabeth II was crowned Queen of the United Kingdom in 1953. She wore the crown and robe of a British monarch, which weren't just bits of tinsel. The crown and robe were glorious because they were to display the glory of the monarch and the British Empire. So it wasn't all just for show. Now, the glory of the British Empire, though diminished at that point in history, was real. Britain still extended its rule over many parts of the world. Now, we're told in Psalm 93 that the Lord reigns, that he wears a robe which displays his glory, the glory of his majesty and power. But is it real? How does God's rule work itself out in reality? What are the realms or territories over which he reigns? Where are they? And what's it got to do with you and me? We have 2 points. Point number one, the rule of God on earth. Now, in the history of the world, empires have come and empires have gone. Empires rise and empires fall. And there have been many great empires in the ancient world. There was the Assyrian Empire, which came and went. The Babylonian Empire came and went. Persian Empire, likewise. Greek, Roman, others since. All have come and gone. Each empire can be judged on the basis of the extent of its rule, the length of its reign, and perhaps the happiness of its people. Now we're told, Psalm 93, that God reigns. Let's ask the question, over what exactly does God reign? Verse 1. The Lord reigns, he is robed in majesty. The Lord is robed, he has put on strength as his belt. And listen, yes, the world is established, it shall never be moved. What is uppermost in mind is not so much the people in the world is established, but the earth, the stuff of the earth. God rules over the earth. He rules over the created order, beginning at creation, because he established it at creation, and now he rules over the whole of the earth, the stuff of the earth, the mountains, the rivers, the seas, the plants. That's what's in mind. Now, what many people today might call the laws of nature is the rule of God over the earth. God has established the earth and sustains it. Every part of it. The whole earth. There's no part of the earth which is not under God's rule. The earth can't go it alone. No part of it can go independent. God has established it. He rules over it and he sustains it. Now, God governs the earth everywhere. The psalmist could speak of it being established, that it will not move, it shall never be moved. In other words, the rule of God over creation is so firm, so established, that nature is consistent, reliable, and dependable all over the earth because God rules over it and sustains it. Now, we take that for granted. But let's think of a very ordinary instance in which this works itself out in reality. Think about boiling a kettle. You English folk, I figured this would relate to you very well. If you boil a kettle in Twickenham, in your home, the water will boil at 100 degrees centigrade. If you boil a kettle in Outer Mongolia, the water will boil at 100 degrees centigrade. If you boil a kettle tomorrow morning in Mexico City, the water will boil at 100 degrees centigrade. Now, why? Why is there a consistency by which the natural world operates? Because God rules over it consistently at all times. The pattern of behavior of the natural world doesn't change. They're established. As long as God rules over it and sustains it, it doesn't move around. The world is established. It shall not be moved. Now, we take that for granted. It's because God is holding it together by the word of his power. But there's more. The laws by which nature operates doesn't originate from within nature itself. We're so used to the consistency of the natural world, we take it for granted. But where does the consistency originate? Well, we find in beginning of verse 2, your throne is established from of old, you are from everlasting. The God of heaven, who is outside of time, has established his rule over creation. His throne is in heaven, but he extends his rule over the earth. His dominion extends into the earth. He rules over the earth from heaven. So God rules over creation from heaven. The laws by which God governs the earth don't originate from nature. He sustains it from heaven. So God has real power, real majesty. His robe is not just for show. He really does reign. And he reigns over the natural order. Empires rise, empires fall. But God's rule is eternal because it's established in heaven. Now, think about this. The God who's in heaven, who is transcendent, that's a fancy word, rules over the earth, which means he's here, which means he's imminent, that's another fancy word. He's near. God hasn't wound up the earth and walked away, like a clock, right? Walked away, for it to govern itself. No, he actively rules over it, governs it. God actively rules over the creation which he has made. So, God cares for the natural world. He feeds the animal kingdom. He waters the plants. When God withholds his hands of provision, animals die. Plants wither. When God provides, animals live. And the fields are covered with green and are filled with beauty and color. That's what's really going on. Because that's how God governs the world. The world didn't create itself. God created the world. The world doesn't uphold and establish itself. God has established the earth. The world doesn't sustain itself. God sustains the earth. Now let's draw some lessons. God rules over creation, over the stuff of the earth. If God rules over the earth, then you, if you're a child of God, are safe. Now think about it. Think about a friend that many of you here would know, John Tilson. John introduced me to Triumph Dolomites. Some of you may not know John, but follow me. Now, I don't know anything about cars, let alone classic cars. I didn't know what a Dolomite was until I met John. And he had several of them. I don't think anyone knew how many he had. Some of them were barely roadworthy, but to John, they were precious. Now, you know what John was like. John was eccentric, to say the least. But I'll never forget something that Paul Fountain told me about John. He said this. He said, John was the most sacrificial person he's ever met. Now, some of you don't know John, but I know this is true because I've tasted it. There was a time when I was in need, and John turned into a Superman and came to my help. The point I'm seeking to make is this. That John cared for his classic cars. But when it came to friends, I was a fringe friend, and he helped me out. When it came to friends and family, he loved them. He'd drop anything to help them out. That was John. Now, God cares over the stuff of the earth. Right? He cares for the creation. He clothes the grass of the field. He feeds the animals. He cares for it. He sustains it. Moment by moment, by his power. Right? We care for stuff that we don't really care about. But we drop everything to care for the people that we really love. God cares and sustains the created order. He cares for it. How much more will he care for you if you're his child? Now, none of what I'm saying is original. In the Sermon on the Mount, which really ought to be called the Sermon of the King, Jesus said this. If God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you? Or think of how God cares for the animal kingdom. Matthew 10, Jesus said this. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. But even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore. You are more valuable than many sparrows. What are you saying? If God provides for the animals and the plants, will he not provide for you? Think of how God sustains the natural world, the stuff of the earth, providentially. If God arranges and orders the operation of the natural world to such levels of consistency and reliability, so much that we just call it the laws of nature because it's that dependable, will he not arrange the affairs of your life? If God providentially rules over the stuff of the earth, will he not rule in your life for your good and his glory? Maybe things have happened in your life that you wish didn't. Maybe things have not worked out in your life as you wished and as you planned. But if you're a child of God, nothing has gone wrong. Because God's purposes for you are exactly for your good, planned, and for his glory. He rules over every affair in your life. His rule in the affairs of your life will not be less careful than his rule over the natural world, because he cares for you more. Maybe you live in the past. Maybe you live in the world of if only. If only I hadn't done this. If only I hadn't done that. If only that didn't happen to me. If only I didn't make that decision. If only. Friends, what matters more to God? The stuff of the earth over which he rules, or your life? Will he not rule over your life with greater care and tenderness in every area of your life? He rules over your life and the very situation in which you find yourself. Now, maybe tonight you're not a Christian. You don't know God. I want to tell you this. You can know the God who reigns over the earth. You can know him. Because he's not distant. He's near. He rules in heaven and on earth. So he's not aloof. He's not distant. He cares for what he's made. When speaking to people who lived in Athens 2,000 years ago, the Apostle Paul said this. God is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. God gives you your very breath. You might have heard of people talking about coming into the presence of God. You don't need to go anywhere to come into the presence of God. You are in the presence of God. You can call upon God now, and he will reveal himself to you. You can come into the unveiled presence of God, but you're in it. So you can speak to God now. You can call upon God now. You can ask God to reveal himself to you tonight. And he will, because he loves to do it. God's rule over the earth. Second point. The voice of God on earth. And look with me at verses 3 and 4. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their roaring. Mightier than the thunders of many waters. Mightier than the waves of the sea. The Lord on high is mighty. Now, it's interesting. I don't know if you noticed this, but of all creation, the psalmist chooses the voice of the waters to demonstrate, at least in this instance, the majesty of God. That the creation speaks of his creator. Everything we make speaks about us, if we made it, right? What we make says something about us. It's true of us individually. From our handwriting, cooking, baking, DIY, everything. Because we leave our stamp upon it, and others can recognize us through them. And it's true of us also corporately. So Apple make iPhones, and say something about that brand, doesn't it? Tesla make electric cars. Now, these are obviously carefully crafted messages about those items. But whether we carefully plan it or not, what we make says something about us. And what God has made says something about him. And here we're told, the crashing waves of the sea and the rushing of rivers say something about God. They speak. Now, the sound that they make is analogous to the voice of God. Verse 3. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their roaring. Now, God doesn't have an audible voice. But he does speak. And when he speaks, it's a commanding voice. He gets things done. That's the point. When you stand before the crashing waves of the sea or beside a mighty rushing river, it can feel overwhelming. Why? Because there's power. It's raw power. We harness raw power in the earth, don't we, to generate electricity, wind energy, for instance. But the waves of the sea, the mighty rivers, that's a display of power. Well, it says something about the power of God. God, by his voice, displays power because he gets things done. And that's the sense of it. And verse 5, your decrees are very trustworthy. Now, that's a difficult translation. Another translation puts it this way. The rules you set down are completely reliable. The parallel is this. That the waters display power. But God, by his voice, gets things done. That's a parallel. God's voice, God's decree, always gets things done. It's a commanding voice. God's voice spoke the universe into existence. It was done. God determines the unfolding of history. God says it, speaks it, it is done. God declares the end of the beginning. Why? Because he's God. He speaks, it is done. God's voice demonstrates power. Now, but there's something else going on in this psalm. I don't know if you noticed it. The earth is spoken of as being established, but the waters are chaotic. You walk around on land, you're safe. Try to get out into the sea, don't feel so safe anymore. Because the waters are unstable and chaotic. So the language of verses 3 and 4 is saying this, that there are parts of the creation which resist God's rule. So it begins by saying the floods have lifted up as if they're resisting God's rule. But God is mightier than the mighty waters, verse 4. Mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea, The Lord on high is mighty. So something unstable, threatening, chaotic as the sea, God subdues it. He's already established the earth. But he will subdue the sea. In the unfolding of history, God is working out his purposes, his decree. There are forces in the created order which resist God's rule, but God will deal with them. He will defeat them. He's mightier than them. That's what the psalm is saying. I want to draw some lessons here. So God's rule over the natural world is simply just by speaking, by his word. God rules over the unfolding of history. He speaks it. He decrees it. And God will defeat his enemies, again, just by his word. Now, if you're a Christian and you look at the world in which we live, man seems center stage. Man seems to hold the microphone. You look around, those who know Christ, those who love God, seem few and far between. Man seems center stage. And it's tempting then to become fearful and discouraged and retreat into a Christian bubble. Fearful that the wicked hold the microphone. Wicked people hold center stage. As if God isn't in control. As if God isn't reigning. As if God isn't in control. But listen. The writer of the Hebrew puts it this way. And he's describing a definitive moment in history when Christ defeated all his enemies and then sat on the throne from which or from where he reigns, not just in heaven, but on earth. It says this, when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies shall be made a footstool for his feet. The definitive battle to secure God's kingdom on earth has been fought. And if you're a Christian, if you're a Christian in God's army, if I could put it that way, you don't retreat in the face of victory. Yes, you retreat in the face of defeat. But if now is not the time for retreat. That's the point. Now is the time for advance. Why? Because the king is sitting on the throne. He reigns over the created order. He reigns over the unfolding of history. He reigns now. As you look around, it may not seem like that. But this psalm is telling us that Jesus Christ is sitting in heaven as the king. Our king. Your king. He's ordering your life for your good, his glory. He's ordering redemptive history, the unfolding of the kingdom of God in history for your good and his glory. Because he's the king. Okay, so we are in southwest London and it's affluent and people are indifferent to the gospel. And we make Christ known and there's very little response. What can we accomplish? Think about it. As much as God can accomplish by his voice. Because God gets everything done by speaking. What do Christians do when they're discouraged? They stop praying. Because they've lost sight of the king who sits on the throne. What do Christians do when they're discouraged? They stop waiting on God because they've lost sight of the God who rules. What do Christians do when they're discouraged? They stop being actively obedient because they've lost sight of the God who's spoken and given us commands to which to be obedient. Have you stopped praying? Have you stopped waiting on God? Have you stopped being actively obedient? But I want to close with this. Psalm 93 is a psalm that that sits in a collection of psalms, from Psalm 90 through to Psalm 100. And there is one theme that unites them all. There's one central theme, and it's a theme of the reign of God, or the kingdom of God. You'll see it time and again in those psalms. So I'm just going to flick through a couple of psalms, two or three psalms. Psalm 97 begins with these words: "The Lord reigns, let the earth rejoice, let the many coastlands be glad." Psalm 98, "Oh, sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have worked salvation for him." I'm just going to read one more. Psalm 99, verse 1, "The Lord reigns, let the people tremble. He sits enthroned upon the cherubim. Let the earth quake." These psalms are a collection. You know what a collection is? It's a collection of songs. You've got your collection of songs. It used to be an album, now it's a playlist. These are songs that are sung together, particular times, particular occasions. And they are looking back at particular moments in history, in Israel's history, God's historic people, when God's kingdom made particular advances. So God rescuing his people, Israel, out of Egypt, God leading them across the Red Sea, God establishing them in the Promised Land, God raising a king, King David, to rule over them. These psalms point to those events. The imagery is borrowed from those events. Now, the events that unfolded in the past, to which these psalms point to some extent, that is not the kingdom of God that they ultimately point to. Simon picked up on this morning. Because the world in which we live presently doesn't look like, demonstrably doesn't look like, it's a world in which God reigns completely. I mean, you look at the world. It's messed up. Because we're messed up. Right? People are hurting each other. Okay, it's a wicked world. Because our hearts are wicked. And ultimately, we have an enemy. Sin. And death. This is not a world in which God demonstrably reigns. People are not safe. I'm not safe. You're not safe. And ultimately, we don't enjoy communion with God that is unaffected by sin. As a race, as a human race, we're cut off from God. And we're under his anger because of sin. So, the reign of God, of which these psalms, and Psalm 93 in particular, points, is something else altogether that is yet to be fulfilled demonstrably. Now, note this. When Jesus Christ came into the world 2,000 years ago, and he began his public ministry, he proclaimed this. You read it in Matthew 4. "The kingdom of heaven," or the kingdom of God, "is here." Jesus proclaimed at his coming that the kingdom of which Psalm 93 and all the other psalms point is here. He's saying these psalms point to, I'm the king. I'm the one who's going to establish God's rule on earth. You see, Jesus Christ came into the world to deal with sin. Because it's sin that separates us from God. If God is going to dwell in the midst of his people, in his holiness, then we must be holy. And in Psalm 93, verse 5, I'm just going to pick it up. "Your decrees are very trustworthy. Holiness befits your house." When God dwells in his house amongst his people, holiness, that we have to be holy because he's holy. This is a reign of holiness. Look at the world. It's not a holy world, is it? It's not a whole world that is filled with beauty and righteousness. It's a wicked world. There is a kingdom in which every citizen is holy. How does that happen? Jesus Christ, having lived a beautiful, perfect life, went to a place and was punished in the place of sinners. the one who's holy became unholy. The one who was sinless became sin. And God poured out his wrath, his curse upon the human race, his curse upon the world, poured it upon him. And Jesus Christ died and then rose again. So those people who trust in him, who come to him, who believe in him, are made holy. They experience the advance of the kingdom of God in their very hearts, in their very souls. They're born again. They come into the knowledge of God. They become Christians. God makes them holy. That is the kingdom which is on the advance. And every local church where you've got Christians, that is the kingdom demonstrably here on earth. And there'll come a time when Christ comes again and he will consummate his kingdom. There'll be a new heavens, a new earth in which righteousness dwells. This psalm is a kingdom psalm. God is king over the created order. Of course he is. But there are forces that still oppose him. He will crush them. Every single one of them. And he will reign forever. Now, are you one of his? Are you one of his? You can be. Because he's here. You can call upon him. You can cry to him. He'll make you a child of God. And if you are a child of God, you are in the safest place. Because he rules from heaven on earth for your good and his glory.